Hello and welcome to USSOcast, a US Studies online podcast. Here we chat to PhDs, ECAs, researchers and writers working in American studies about their work, their life in academia, and all things in between. I'm Sarah Collier, and today I'm joined by Naomi Sutton and Meg Walters, who are going to chat a bit about Nora Ephron, the internet phenomenon of Meg Ryan Fall and all things rom-coms. Naomi Sutton is a postgraduate researcher at the University of Manchester, where her work focuses on film and politics. She graduated with a BA in history from the University of Cambridge and an MA in US history and politics from UCL. Her current research focuses on the construction of gender in 1980s America through the films of Goldie Hawn. And Meg Walters is a freelance writer based in London. Her work focuses on film, TV and pop culture, and has appeared in publications like GQ, Glamour, The Daily Beast, Little White Lies, and more. So welcome, both of you. Thank you so much for joining me today on USSOcast.
Hi. Yep. Thanks for having us.
Hi. Yeah, excited.
So you're both big Nora Ephron fans, and you've both written about what is known as this internet aesthetic, Meg Ryan Fall. So I just wondered, what is Meg Ryan Fall? What does it mean for both of you?
So Meg Ryan Fall is basically a trend that has emerged online in the past few years, whereby a lot of mostly young women jump on board what they see as the Meg Ryan look, I suppose, from the Nora Ephron rom-com trilogy, which typically is Sleepless in Seattle, You've Got Mail, and When Harry Met Sally. So we're talking a lot of, you know, chunky knitwear, khaki, Oxfords, blazers, you know, sort of 90s, understated, intellectual, Upper West Side New York. So yeah, we're seeing a lot of, you know, tweets, TikTok videos with pictures of Meg in her cute little outfits. And, you know, girls dressing up in this Meg Ryan look. Yeah, and it's sort of taken off, like millions of views, likes. People just love doing a bit of Meg Ryan in the fall.
And is it something that, like, is it something that you actively engage in if you, you know, if you like follow the aesthetic online? Or do you think it kind of seeps into people's own sort of personal dress and taste and aesthetic without sort of realizing the influence of the films?
Yeah, I think there is a bit of people see these films, which are set in, well, not always, but they do often feature scenes that sort of glorify or make the fall look very, very nice in New York City. So, you know, it's just a very pleasant, pleasing version of autumn, which becomes aspirational for people. So that look has become synonymous, I suppose, with, you know, the ideal version of fall.
Yeah, and I think what I was interested in terms of your article, Meg, was that it's about, you know, what is the meaning behind them actually doing this, and, you know, what meaning is lost in Meg Ryan Fall and just taking the, you know, aesthetics of these films. And, you know, and I think that's been, you know, that's what my research is, you know, primarily focused on Goldie Hawn, because she's someone who's, you know, been often lost because people believe she has no meaning because of how she's been perceived since. And going back and reading about, you know, I've been reading a lot of old Nora Ephron journalism, and, you know, the extent to which, you know, these films, their aesthetics are meaningful, and Nora Ephron, I mean, I don't know her personally, I probably shouldn't call her Nora, but Nora Ephron deliberately, you know, makes all these choices, and, you know, how we get from, you know, her early journalism to Meg Ryan Fall is such a, you know, interesting journey.
I completely agree. I think it's Meg Ryan Fall has become, by virtue of being on social media, very much about this look. But yeah, as I said before, something that people are, I think, reaching for when they put on that blazer or that turtleneck is the feeling behind what we see in the Nora Ephron rom-coms. So, you know, the feeling of being in love with someone new and exciting, the feeling of, I think hope is a big part of it, sort of just hope for your life, for the future, happy-go-lucky kind of feeling, which for many young women today isn't always that prevalent in their lives. So yeah, I think there's the sense that if you emulate Meg Ryan in this instance, maybe you'll feel that way too during the fall. And it's definitely something that I think I used to do and probably still do a little bit, because, you know, the clothes you wear influence how you feel when you're going about your day, I think. And when they're connected to these feelings and these films, it can feel just a little bit more exciting and meaningful.
Yeah, definitely. Because in, you know, thinking about this, and I was thinking about, you know, When Harry Met Sally and kind of why that was so comforting, and, you know, why it emerged. And I mean, what you're describing is exactly what Nora Ephron, like, wanted that film to be. You know, it appears in, you know, the end of the 1980s, and there's been a decade where, you know, people have been really fraught over the, you know, state of romance. I mean, at that time, you know, people considered the rom-com to be pretty much dead. This comes from, there's an article by In Film Quarterly in the late 1970s, I think it's 1978, by Brian Henderson, and he basically declares, you know, the rom-com is dead because, you know, 60s feminism has changed fulfillment for women, and it's no longer the fulfillment of a heterosexual couple, it's self-fulfillment. And he said, you know, in that case, how can the rom-com exist if the tropes and the structure of it, you know, can't exist with that sort of attitude? I mean, he's talking about a film called Semi-Tough, which is a pretty forgotten Burt Reynolds film, but he's predominantly talking about Woody Allen films, you know, like Annie Hall and Manhattan, which is essentially about a man who's worried about the effect of feminism on his ability to have romances. And this is, you know, I mean, Henderson's not right. And by the early 1990s, people are arguing there's, you know, there are rom-coms in the 80s, obviously. They're often called new romances. But, you know, there's that period with the 70s and 80s where people are like really worried about romance being dead. And obviously at the same time, there's, you know, all the Reagan New Right stuff about, you know, reintroducing traditional morals into family life, and a lot of stuff about abortion and the regulation of women's bodies, as well as, you know, the AIDS epidemic, which is, you know, completely the government doesn't take responsibility for. And, you know, there's a great moral panic over that. And then, you know, Nora Ephron writes a film that, you know, is deliberately trying to reclaim those, like, old romantic, you know, cliches or tropes, you know, to make that comforting. It's deliberately there to, you know, move against all these films like Fatal Attraction and, you know, War of the Roses and things like that, that, you know, pretty much anything Michael Douglas is in. But, you know, and that's what she wants. And I think that's why, you know, just taking the aesthetics of it without trying to think about the meaning, as, you know, Meg Ryan Fall does, you know, really undervalues the power of that comfort and, you know, the reasons why that film was so successful in a, you know, a big blockbuster summer.
Would you say that that she sort of rewrote the language of the rom-com in that sense?
I think she definitely... she definitely wanted to reclaim the language of romance. I mean, this is kind of what my article is talking about, is, you know, in Sleepless in Seattle, they use An Affair to Remember, and they take all those tropes and they make it part of that film. And, you know, films, old romantic films, are so important in, you know, Nora Ephron's films, particularly When Harry Met Sally, Sleepers in Seattle, and You've Got Mail. You know, when Harry Met Sally, it's a lot of it's structured around Casablanca. You know, initially Meg Ryan says she would go with Victor Laszlo because, and I always remember because she says women are very practical, and then she very satisfyingly smacks the lid on the hairspray, and then later she says to Harry, like, I would never say that, and it's like her character development is through her understanding of Casablanca, which is the same for Annie in Sleepless in Seattle. And I mean, You've Got Mail's slightly different, but that is a remake of a 30s film called Shop Around the Corner with Jimmy Stewart. So yeah, they're all about reclaiming these old tropes for the modern day and making them, giving them meaning in the 1990s.
Yeah, I really loved your article and how it looked at the way she plays with different sources from the past, mm-hmm. and the character's nostalgia for those old films. I mean, if you look back at sort of old 1930s, 1940s rom-coms, they are amazing rom-coms. Like, they really did very, very well at showing idealistic, dreamy sort of romance, but also showing women as strong, independent, witty, funny characters. Like some of those old screwball comedies, I don't know, like Bring Up Babies, yeah. Amazing, Philadelphia Story. There's a reason why those decades produce some of the best, I think, still best romantic comedies. And then there is kind of a lull throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, where it changes. And it obviously is a reflection of social politics at the time and how women were perceived, how they were being written in films. It's telling that Nora Ephron includes references to all these sort of old Hollywood movies. What you talk about in your article is also really interesting, in that her references to them don't necessarily take into consideration everything that was going on at the time. You know, it wasn't a perfect time for women.
Yeah.
But their version of nostalgia is to look at it through these sort of rose-tinted glasses, in a very similar way to how people now look at the Nora Ephron movies. Yeah, because it is very easy to look at them and think, wow, what an amazing way to fall in love. What a beautiful version of New York City. Everyone's happy, but it's ignoring the fact that, yeah, these are all white characters and they're all very wealthy. And yet we still look back with extreme fondness for them.
I wanted to ask about race, actually. And that was thinking about kind of the whiteness of the films, but then also, how does that reflect into the aesthetic? Do you think that there is a certain way in which whiteness resonates between the films and the aesthetic, or has that sort of changed with the internet and the co-option of the aesthetic itself?
One of the interesting things I was reading when I was reading, and they released, I didn't actually know this, a couple of months ago, Nora Ephron's like whole anthology of all her work. And it's got an introduction by Candice Carty-Williams, who's a Black British author. And it's a really good introduction. It's essentially like, why am I, as you know, a Black British woman, why am I so connected to Nora Ephron, who's a, you know, non-practicing Jewish woman from New York? And what, you know, what is that connection there? And she's basically saying, you know, that Nora's dialogue, her, you know, her anxieties, her wit, you know, is something that can be very personal. And she says it's like, you know, having a conversation with a friend, and, you know, someone who makes you laugh, and it's a very, I mean, it's a very well-written introduction, but it also speaks to, you know, how popular culture, these films are very white. And I think one of the interesting things I was reading in the examples in the anthology was, you know, Nora was writing about her time at Wellesley, which is a women's college that Nora went to in the 50s and 60s, when it was very, you know, white, traditional system. And, you know, they very much wanted traditional ambitions for women. And she goes back to like a school reunion, and she's very keen to get rid of, you know, the what she considers like the old guard, which are these white, you know, old men who were in charge of the college. And she's calling for, you know, more non-white students. You know, she has like statistics on, you know, the number of, you know, Black students, the number of Asian students. And it was quite surprising to me, because I didn't consider that she's no way being radical here. You know, it's not, you know, she could obviously do a lot more for, you know, intersectional, you know, ideas of feminism. But it was really interesting to me, because she's also talking about the acceptance, more acceptance of divorce and sexual freedom and repeal of anti-LGBT attitudes in Wellesley. And it was really quite interesting to me, because it makes me think about what is the purpose of the whiteness of the films, though, you know, When Harry Met Sally, you know, things like that. And, you know, I don't have an answer to that, because I don't know. But it was just really interesting to see that, you know, she was aware of these issues, and she was talking about them pretty, you know, before those films were made.
And do you think that how do non-Americans engage with something that's quite identifiably American, such as this aesthetic of Meg Ryan-Fall and Nora Ephron films in general?
Well, as a Canadian, I think it's probably quite different than British viewers of her films, simply because we are exposed to so much American pop culture as kids. It kind of feels, I think, for a lot of Canadians, I mean, we're so geographically close. We all live sort of on the very border, cusp of the border to America. So, I mean, as a kid and young teenager, it felt not too distant from my world. Although I guess New York in itself is, it's almost its own cultural bubble, even in America. Yeah, I guess the other thing is, as a non-American, it is easier in a way to view it through, yeah, those rose-tinted glasses.
Yeah, I mean, I always think about that in terms of, you know, I started watching When Harry Met Sally when I was like 11, 12, and I used to watch it like every day for months. What I, as a, you know, a working class girl from Manchester, thought I had in common with, you know, them going to the deli, or you like, or like, you know, doing all their like little, her like picking up pumpkin, you're like, what was I doing? And, you know, there was just something really comforting about it, I think, is, you know.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think that, like, there is that kind of, as we keep going back to, the feeling behind the look. And there's something that's really, I think, with like Americana in general, there's something really compelling about that. But yeah, it's interesting to hear your perspective, Meg, sort of on the other side of that.
Meg, you mentioned that you read Heartburn.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with the rom-coms is, for one thing, they're what everyone knows of Nora Ephron. I mean, the rest of her work is popular, but just not on the same level. So Heartburn was her first novel, and it very closely follows her own life. So it's about her second marriage. So her second marriage to Carl Bernstein, a journalist.
He broke the Watergate scandal. It's one of my favorite Nora Ephron stories, because they were, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein broke Watergate, and they did this through a FBI secret anonymous contact called Deep Throat, who ended up being called Mark Feltz, who was like high up in the FBI. And Nora Ephron, and this was like a big secret, like no one knew for like 40 years. And Nora Ephron, it's actually in the anthology, the essay she writes. She said, yeah, I knew it was Mark Phelps. I used to go around telling everyone it was Mark Phelps and no one listened to me. And she basically writes, you know, after it's revealed it's him, she's like, I told you so. I've been telling you for like decades. It's like one of the biggest secrets of American politics. Anyway, so carry on.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Well, what I love about the book as well is she moves to DC to live with him after marrying him. And there are some really, really funny moments where she's going to these sort of political dinner parties and not really knowing what to talk about, what to say. And when they leave, her husband will say things like, oh, maybe if you read anything other than the style section, you would know what to talk about. Clearly a very healthy marriage. But yeah, I think she probably did know more than she let on. But the novel follows her second marriage and the sort of collapse of this marriage when he cheats on her while she's pregnant with their second kid. And it's not what you'd expect from Nora Ephron if you're coming to it from the rom-coms, because it's a very honest, very real, quite bitter look at love, yeah, and relationships from sort of the other end, which I think is really interesting. People often probably assume that Nora was this sort of fuzzy, light character, like the Meg Ryan characters in those films. But I don't think she was necessarily. And her essays, I'm sure, also reveal that sort of that side of her.
Yeah. My one of my favorite Nora Ephron quotes is, I think it's from a blog post in like 2000s. It's, never marry a man you wouldn't want to be divorced from. And I think that's, you know, exactly what you're saying. Like, there is a warmth there, you know, marry a nice man, but ultimately it's incredibly pessimistic and caustic and, you know, quite cold. And, you know, she has a number of films that she directs, you know, Mixed Nuts, Lucky Numbers, My Cult, you know, just aren't hits. And it's because they do not have these warm, fluffy ending, you know, these happy endings. They're not, I mean, one of the things that interests me about When Harry Met Sally and her writing is, in her original script, she didn't make them get together at the end. Like, they are not a couple at the end of that film. And I think everyone was like, no, that's not gonna, no one's gonna like that. So she definitely has this, you know, as you say, you know, much darker side that I think is often lost because of, you know, those three films in particular.
Yeah, this all comes back to what we're talking about with the sort of the way Meg Ryan Fall as a trend makes her work more surface level than it really is. I mean, even though those three rom-coms are very sweet, very happy, very optimistic, pro-romance, there are elements to her writing that have that bite, that, yeah, bite to it. So I think people maybe need to, you know,
yeah,
reassess how they watch these films as well.
Yeah, because I was, you know, the scene in When Harry Met Sally where she's talking about her sex fantasy of a faceless man ripping her clothes off. I was watching, there's a good documentary that I would recommend called Everything is Copy, and it's made by Nora Ephron's son after she's died. It's very sad. It's essentially him trying to investigate, because she gets, now I'm pretty sure it's leukemia, but that, please correct me if I'm wrong. But she has it for years and she doesn't tell anyone, not even like her close family. And it's essentially about him investigating Nora Ephron's life and, you know, why she would keep that a secret when, as in the title, everything is copy. She used everything from her life. As you were saying about heartburn, that is, well, pretty close to what happened with Carl Bernstein and why she kept this big secret. But in that, it's a really good documentary, but it's really good at showing how her early, like, I'm going to call it feminist writings, but obviously, you know, there's, you could argue the extent to which it was feminist, but how they become part of her films, and that scene where she's talking about her sex fantasy is just verbatim an article she wrote in the 70s, you know, and you might just think of that scene as, you know, like a kind of throwaway joke, but it actually has this like long history of like that post-sexual liberation moment, and it leads all the way up to, you know, 12, 15 years later, and it's in that film. And, you know, if you just, you know, beneath what seems like, as you say, you know, a more superficial veneer, there's actually a lot going on in these films.
It almost feels like until the very final scene of all of these films, if you really think about it, none of these characters should even be together. And it's unclear if their relationships in reality would be healthy and successful.
I think it's one of the biggest cinematic triumphs is You've Got Mail, in which, you know, it's the halfway point that Tom Hanks works out that Meg Ryan is the person. Well, if you don't know the plot of You've Got Mail, is that Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan are AOL email friends, but they don't know each other's identity, and they're also in quote unquote real life. Tom Hanks owns a big bookstore and he's trying to close down her bookstore. But they don't know that they're like email soulmates, you know, initially. But Tom Hanks finds out that an hour into the film, and he essentially spends the last like hour and a bit of the film manipulating her. And then at the end, you're supposed to be like, yes, they're together, great. And she's like, I'm so glad it was you. And if you just stop and think about it, it's the same with Sleepers in Seattle. Like, Meg Ryan is stalking Tom Hanks for the entire film. And, you know, when I first, you know, you don't really think about it. I mean, I think that's the strength of her, you know, what she's doing, you know, reclaiming these tropes and her writing and her wit, you know, really, you know, never underestimate a happy ending in making you forget about. I don't know if you want to talk about Meg Ryan, but I think she's also immensely important to those films being, you know, successful.
Yeah, she definitely has a quality that just makes her instantly likable. And I think clearly very relatable to a wide range of different women. Yeah, and of course, all the characters in these films are different, but she brings this kind of, it's impossible not to sort of side with her.
Yeah,
everything she does. So,
yeah, I mean, because I think, you know, we've been kind of saying that, you know, these films have kind of defined Nora Ephron, and, you know, she has this darker side that people often overlook because these films are so important. I think the same is definitely for, you know, Meg Ryan. You know, these films have defined how she's understood, and, you know, I mean, to almost her downfall, you know, when in the early 2000s, you know, she starts trying to make a lot of like what I would describe as thrillers, often sex thrillers. In the Cut is the kind of the final one, and people don't want to see her not as Meg Ryan in a Nora Ephron film. And, you know, that's really difficult. And I mean, if you compare it to what these films have an effect on Tom Hanks's career, who spend, I won't start talking about Tom Hanks for a long time, but, you know, in the 80s and early 90s, Tom Hanks plays like very, his star persona is bitter, and he plays these really like caustic, it's probably why he works well in Nora Ephron films. You know, he's not like what he becomes, which is like America's dad. It's in You've Got Mail that Janet Maslin's like a critic for the film critic for the New York Times, and that's the first time she describes Tom Hanks as the modern Jimmy Stewart, and that's something that sticks with him and kind of allows Tom Hanks to transition this almost like transcendental, you know, movie star who is beloved, whereas Meg Ryan can't escape these films and they almost trap her and they don't allow her to move beyond them. And I mean, this is about, you know, how women are treated in Hollywood and the construction of women in Hollywood, but it speaks to, you know, the sadness of that, but also the strength of her performances in these films and how much meaning they have for people, you know, they don't want to see her outside of these roles.
Well, it's the same. It's kind of the same phenomenon that happened with Nora Ephron herself. As you said, her later, a lot of her later films that didn't follow this tidy little rom-com format were far less successful because people just didn't want to see them.
Yeah, definitely.
To wrap the interview up then, I wanted to ask both of you, what's your favourite Nora Ephron film and why?
Oh, that's so difficult. Because it's one of those, it's, I mean, I would, if someone asked me what's my favourite film, I always say When Harry Met Sally. It's, you know, it's tight, it's 90 minutes, it's pretty flawless, you know, for me. But I do have a real soft spot for You've Got Mail. I think it's just the nostalgia of them clicking on those keys, and it's just so, it's just so warm. When Harry Met Sally, I'm talking myself out of it, but When Harry Met Sally.
Okay, I am gonna go with You've Got Mail. Just no, I think because show. Yeah, I think because not because it's the best one. I think if I'm looking at them critically, it might even be my least favorite. But in terms of my personal connection to it, it's was sort of my entry point into the Nora Ephron rom-com. And it really is the epitome of a comfort film for me, which I think is okay. I love her strutting down the street to the Cranberries. Yeah. I love her putting up silly little like twinkle lights in the shop, the Cafe Lalo scene. I just really, really enjoy watching it and can watch it anytime, any place. So
yeah, I concur. I think of the three, I never watched Sleepless in Seattle as much, and I think it's just because they're apart for so much of the film, and it's not in New York. I don't know what it is about New York that makes it seem more comforting, but and it's not as auto, you know, it's just it's slightly more the odd one out, I would say. But I still very much enjoy it, but no, definitely When Harry Met Sally and You've Got Mail. There, When Harry Met Sally just peaks it for me, I think. But I do have a real soft spot for You've Got Mail.
It's interesting, actually, that you bring up the specificity of the sense of comfort that comes from New York. I wonder if there's something to be said about the kind of pre and post 9/11 moment with that. I would have to think about it myself. but yeah, it just struck me. Okay, anyway, well, thank you both so much for coming on. That was a really, really interesting discussion. I'm really happy that we got to get you both together to chat.
No, I had a great time. Thanks so much for organising it and for agreeing to do it, Meg. I've been really interested in what you've written and everything you've been saying. It's been great.
Yeah, thank you. I had a really great time. It's great to meet you too.
And you can read Naomi's article on Reclaiming Choice in Sleepless in Seattle and Meg Ryan-Fall right here on USSO. That's up now. And you can also read Meg's piece on Meg Ryan-Fall on The Daily Beast. And I'm going to post a link to both of those articles in the bio.